This hour of the Jason Rant Show brought to you by PRMI, Primary Residential Mortgage. Today, Washington has a brand new Secretary of State. His name is Senator Steve Hobbs, a Democrat. The first time in more than 50 years that our state has had a Democratic Secretary of State. Of course, you know that Secretary of State Kim Wyman, a Republican who was the last remaining Republican in statewide office on the entire West Coast, announced she was resigning. Technically, today was her last day as that handover happened to her replacement. She is going to be leading up an election security job in the Biden administration. It's something I talked to her about. We're going to play some clips from my interview with now former Secretary of State Kim Wyman in a moment. But first, when it comes to Senator Steve Hobbs, he got sworn in today in front of Washington State Supreme Court Justice Mary Yu.
And that I will faithfully discharge
the duties of Secretary of State.
The duties of Secretary of State.
To the best of my ability.
To the best of my ability.
Congratulations.
Senator Hobbs also thanked Kim Wyman for her work.
I want to thank Secretary Kim Wyman. Thank you for all you've done for the state and your continuing service for our nation. I told you I was going to say a lot of good things about you. It's peppered throughout this whole thing, so if we had a drinking game, you could actually remember it. There's a lot. But that's because you did a lot, and I appreciate that. You left me with a great, great team. And to be honest with you, this is pretty surreal for me. I'm trying not to just pause and just stare for no reason at all, because obviously I'd never expect this to happen to me.
I will say about Senator Steve Hobbs, you know, in this position as a reporter, and especially one that covers politics, you get to know which politicians you like. And which ones are like genuinely good people? And I hear only good things about Steve Hobbs. I will preface this entire segment about that is from Republicans and Democrats alike, people tend to like him. He is more moderate. And that might be why Governor Inslee picked him, as he thought it would be at least somewhat fair to Republicans. Look, there's a lot of controversy around Steve Hobbs being in this position for a variety of reasons. First, you know, Kim Wyman was just reelected in November of 2020. And so, you know, she hadn't even served a year of her term before she announced she was leaving. And that's just not a good look. I mean, I know that she's moving on to do things that she believes she has a calling to do. That's what she told me. It felt like a call to serve. But, you know, it's not a good look to leave less than a year after being elected. We all thought it was Governor Inslee who was going to leave to join the Biden administration after his failed presidential bid. That was a rumor for a long time. He promised he wasn't going to, and he hasn't. I mean, I guess that could change, but we all thought it was Inslee. I never had it on my 2021 bingo card that it would be Secretary Wyman who would leave to join the Biden administration. So Governor Inslee, of course, gets to pick the temporary replacement until the next election. And there are a lot of Republicans in Olympia who felt that it was only fair if the governor put a Republican in that position, considering that voters had just elected a Republican. Now, I don't believe that anyone actually thought that Governor Inslee was going to do that. I mean, that's politics, right? It's fair game. And so he, of course, appointed a Democrat in Steve Hobbs to take over that position. Now, that is not a surprise to me that it would be a Democrat. It is a surprise to me, however, that it would be Steve Hobbs. You know, I've talked to some Democrats and obviously some Republicans, but there's even been some Democrats on Twitter who did not like this decision for one simple reason. Steve Hobbs has absolutely no elections experience whatsoever in any capacity at all. And that's a big job to take on, especially overnight, you know, just being sworn in. He's got to jump right into it. It's not like he ran a campaign where he could spend all that time learning about the job. No elections experience whatsoever. So I got a chance last week to go down to Olympia to sit down with then Secretary of State Kim Wyman as she wrapped up her time before she went to the Biden administration. And I talked to her about the fact that Steve Hobbs has no experience doing what he's about to do.
What he does have is extensive cybersecurity and IT experience, which in the modern era of elections, very, very important to have. We're certainly, you know, I think we've lived and breathed cybersecurity since 2016 and haven't stopped talking about it or focusing on it. Plus, with his experience in the National Guard as a lieutenant colonel. He's led, you know, troops of 700. So to come and oversee an office of 300, I think he's prepared for that. He has a steep learning curve, make no mistake. He's got a lot to learn, not only about elections, but archives, library, corporations and charities, filings, that type of thing. So he's going to have a lot to learn, and we'll have to run for election. So he's going to have a busy year.
So one of the things I asked her is, do you believe that he is qualified? Just a simple question. And she answered by saying, yes, I do, which I thought was a very interesting response, because on the campaign trail in previous election years, Kim Wyman has talked about the inexperience of her opponents. We'll go back to not this past election, but the election before, when she was running against the now head of the Washington State Democratic Party, Tina Pawlodowski. And Tina Pawlodowski had no elections experience. So what do you think Kim Wyman talked about on the campaign trail? The fact that Tina Pawlodowski had no elections experience and thus, you know, wasn't as qualified to be Secretary of State. So having said that about her opponents on the campaign trail, I did think it was very interesting that she was now sitting across from me saying, yes, he's qualified for the job, even though, just like her previous opponents, he has no elections experience. Here's our conversation.
When I was campaigning, and this is not saying that anything's different, that's about competition. And what I think people have always asked me, how do you win as a Republican in such a blue state? And I've had that question asked hundreds of times. And it's that I force them to compete on resume. I've never weighed in on, as you know, who I voted for president, where I stand on any social issue like, you know, abortion or gay marriage or gun rights, any of that type of thing. And part of the reason, part of the benefit of doing that is I force them to compete on resume. They couldn't compete with my resume because I had such extensive experience, not only in elections, but the other parts of the office. So part of that is just sheer competition, and that's what campaigns are about.
Yeah, and that's, to me, that was semantics. You know, she knew, I think she knew she was sort of caught up in a little bit of inconsistency there. It is part of campaigns to, you know, talk about why you were better, but she did not believe that her previous competitors were qualified for the job of Secretary of State because of their lack of elections experience. And so then, you know, I think she's just trying to be diplomatic, be friendly, hand the office off because she's leaving early. You know, and be gracious in how she's handing the office off. But she does acknowledge Steve Hobbs is going to have a steep learning curve. I do suspect that that's why she stayed until after this latest November election, because that would have looked pretty bad had she handed off the whole kit and caboodle to someone with no elections experience right before an election. So we'll have to see how Steve Hobbs does. One of the things that's interesting is Secretary Wyman let me in on the conversations she had with Governor Jay Inslee about her replacement. And she said, you know, she spoke to him, and she didn't specifically give him any names of people she wanted to replace her, but she had, you know, sort of some characteristics that she wanted. And she encouraged the governor to hand off the office to someone who would just be a temporary placeholder, someone who didn't want to run for the office next election. She said that she thought that would be fair. Then you have someone who's just in there focused on doing the job and then let somebody else run to become the next Secretary of State. The governor told her he didn't want to do that. He said that he wanted to put someone in the position who was going to run for the position. And so obviously that tells me that Senator Steve Hobbs is going to run a campaign to become the next Secretary of State. But, you know, depending on, I know there's a lot of county elections officials, both Democrats and Republicans, by the way, across the state, who are also going to run for that job. And they are absolutely going to knock him on his lack of experience. So we'll see what plays out there. I will say again, Senator Hobbs, nice guy, great guy. Everybody has a seat at the table with him, Republicans and Democrats. It's one of the reasons that I respect him so much. And of course, I respect his service to our country and do believe that some of that will come in handy in this new position. So best of luck to him. I mean, we want everybody to succeed in every position that they're in. But Republicans are going to have a really hard time getting that seat back after holding it for decades. Kim Wyman's departure from that office prematurely might mark the end of a very, very long record of voters electing Republican Secretary of States. All right, when we come back from the break, we're going to talk a little bit about why I left my job in corporate media. So as some of you know, if you're familiar, this is Brandi Cruz, by the way, filling in for Jason Rand. Some of you have been on the text line saying, is this Brandi? because you recognize my voice. But Jason is on vacation, lucky him. And so he asked me to fill in for him a couple days this week, which I was more than happy to do, and which I am able to do because, as some of you might know, I quit my job at Fox 13 in Seattle, a job I'd had for about 7 years. And I will let you in on, I guess, the behind the scenes a little bit about why I came to that decision. I'll tell you as much as I can. But also, I want to talk a little bit about, from my perspective, having worked in corporate media for so long, about why I felt as if I would better serve the public by not working in a corporate media environment. If you follow this, or even if you don't, so I announced on a Friday I was resigning from Fox 13. And then a couple days later, I posted this video explaining why.
This is one of the most important moments in history for journalism. I mean, a free press was built for a moment like this. A moment where government at all levels is exerting direct and profound power over people's lives. Yet too many in the mainstream media are falling short of their obligations to question that power. It is our job to challenge the prevailing narrative. If not us, then who? So on Friday, I resigned from my job in corporate media. And at the end of the day, my rationale is simple. I no longer believed that I could work for them and also work for you.
And that really is as simple as it was. You know, this is something that I've been pondering for, I will say, some time now. And, you know, part of it was I would watch local news, including my old station, and I'd watch a newscast and I'd think, God, I got nothing of substance out of that. We could be doing so many more important stories. And I just felt like a combination of, you know, low staffing, which newsrooms are dealing with across the country, but also sort of this, I don't know if it's laziness or just a desire to do, you know, stories that are quick and that you can fill newscasts with. I didn't feel like we were doing a lot of meaningful things. You'll also know that I hosted a show on Fox 13 called The Divide for several years. It actually started during the 2016 presidential election when I really felt the level of discourse in our country plummet. And so I came to my boss at the time and I said, hey, you know, I want to do this segment on bridging divides, on finding common ground on controversial issues. Will you let me do that? And my boss at the time, a woman I absolutely adore to this day, she said, yes, but you can only put it on your Facebook page. So she was like giving me the clearance to do this one little video clip a week on this segment I pitched, The Divide, but I could only put it on my personal Facebook page or on my, you know, Fox 13 Facebook page. But that grew and it grew. It was popular. So it grew from that into they let me put it on the Fox 13 website. Big upgrade. And then a couple years later, we turned it into a full-fledged half-hour show that aired on Sundays before Fox News Sunday. And in doing that show, I felt like I was doing something I found meaningful. We were able to cover stories that the rest of the mainstream local media wasn't covering. I was able to really do the news in a way where I had very little oversight, which to me was a good thing. I didn't want any hands on it. You know, I wanted to say what I felt and be honest and straightforward. But we had, you know, new management come in over there and they made a decision that the show was not going to move forward. And I knew at that point that I was going to leave because it was ending something I found tremendously meaningful and impactful. And so if I couldn't do the show at Fox 13, I was going to do it on my own. And so I started to lay the groundwork for launching an independent show, which I did a couple days after I resigned from Fox 13. It's called Undivided. It is a digital show. It airs on my existing platforms, on Facebook, on Twitter, on YouTube. And I also take subscriptions on Patreon, if you're interested, by the way. This is a free plug time for me. Patreon.com. Can I do this, Peyton?
You have 3 hours to free plug yourself. Feel free, as much as you want.
Yes, I'm taking subscribers for Undivided and for this new adventure, which I'll talk a little bit more about, you know, what I'm hoping to build it into at patreon.com/undivided. And what I call Undivided is political commentary for the anti-fringe. Because I was thinking to myself, and I'm not someone who identifies with either political party. I believe they are both very self-serving and don't have the best interest of their constituents in mind. And so I thought, what is this show going to be? And what am I, you know, personally? And the best way I could describe myself is anti-fringe. you know, anti-fringe on the left and fringe on the right. We have far more left fringe here than anything. But you just see, I got so tired in the mainstream media of being forced to, and by forced, I just mean, you know, I think through pressure, to act as if dumb and dangerous ideas made sense, like police defunding. You know, the media gave the police defunding debate in Seattle an awful lot of legs. There was a lot of hard questions about that that were not asked, I think, for the sake of acting as if, you know, they want to be fair and balanced to everyone. When the reality is, if we're being honest with ourselves, you know, defunding the police at a time of rising crime and rising 911 response times is an incredibly dangerous idea. And I didn't want to pretend otherwise anymore. And so Undivided is political commentary for the anti-fringe. And people asked me when I launched, what is your definition of fringe? Because fringe can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. My definition of fringe is simple. It's you support an idea or an ideology without any care or concern for the potential negative consequences of it. So, for instance, police defunding. If you're not willing to listen to concerns from business owners, from residents about what that could mean for them and their safety, if you're not willing to listen to concerns from people who had to wait an extra 3 minutes for a 911 response in a life or death emergency, you're fringe. You know, I've talked to lawmakers like Senator Joe Wynn, who just lost his bid for King County Executive. You know, Joe Wynn is someone who is, I would call him borderline a police abolitionist. But he is still willing to hear other points of view. And he's, you know, he lives in West Seattle. He's got some neighbors who are Seattle police officers who he talks to about these things. And there's a seat at the table for everyone. So I don't care if you support a fringe idea, be able to back it up with facts, with reason, and then be open to changing your mind if somebody presents you with information that makes sense and that challenges your narrative and your worldview. So that's what I mean by fringe. Fringe is about, I really fundamentally believe it's time. And this is what I was trying to do by leaving my job in corporate media, taking the scary leap of, during a pandemic, walking away from a paycheck, which I'm sure that there are some in my family who are still questioning that decision. But I, just speaking for myself, and I'm sure a lot of people listening, you know, I believe that the majority of Americans are tired of the two political parties. And I believe that the majority of Americans are too scared to speak up because the fringes are so scary. You can't say anything on Facebook or Twitter without people jumping down your throat. And I wanted to start a movement where the media stopped giving so much airtime and attention to the fringes and started focusing on the voices of real Americans with real problems who work hard every day to take care of their families, who are being drowned out by loud voices on the internet. And it is the reality. The media, you know, and that's what sells. Fringe sells, right? Extremism sells. And so the media will get into these stories about, you know, focusing on police defunding and all of this, and then on the other side, and they'll, you know, focus a million hours on the Capitol insurrection, which it was a big deal, don't get me wrong. But then in the middle, you have all these Americans who don't have a voice. The media is not giving them a voice anymore, and they're too scared to speak up because they're scared of the backlash. So that's what Undivided is. It is political commentary for the anti-fringe and for the majority of Americans who are sick of being drowned out by the fringes to their own peril. And so it's been great. Jason Rance has been awesome. You know, he had me on his show right after I launched, and has been so supportive. And I will say that. And Dory Monson over on Cairo Radio, I always laugh when people are so like judgmental of conservative men. Like, two of the most supportive people in my life are Jason Rance and Dory Monson.
Gasp. How
Gasp.
Dare you?
How dare they? Two of the most supportive, kind, generous people in my life and in my career have been those two men. And I'm grateful for them. I'm grateful for all of you who have supported me and sent me messages during this. So if you want to subscribe, patreon.com/undivided. We'll be right back.
Yelp, Tacoma, Bremerton, Bothell.
This is the Big Local on the Jason Rance Show.
Redmond, Sumner, Kent.
Stories about you, not about Seattle.
And this is Brandy Cruz filling in for my friend Jason Rance today. The Big Local is brought to you by Alpine Specialty Cleaning. We're going to head down to the South Sound first. There's this interesting headline that caught my attention on MyNorthwest.com. possible removal of South Sound homeless encampment after crimes found linked to it. I'll tell you in a second why that headline was so intriguing to me, but let's give you a little details. This is an encampment. It's in the city of Fife, but it also borders the city of Tacoma and unincorporated Pierce counties. So there's a lot of entities involved in this. Now, the homeless camp is on a property that's owned by the State Department of Transportation. And, you know, when the headline says possible removal of encampment, why that struck me is that I can't believe it's only a possibility given the type of crimes that have been going on there. Law enforcement recovered 40 stolen vehicles from this encampment, and that is just the tip of the iceberg. Here's the report from Cairo TV.
It's a cold and quiet Saturday at this homeless encampment in Fife. But the location of this camp is colliding head-on with a major state construction project.
We have DOT property inside our city that's moving towards construction for the 167 expansion from Puyallup to the Port of Tacoma. We have numerous individuals that have been living on the state land.
This private property, owned by a public agency, is where the Department of Transportation hopes to expand Highway 167. The two-mile project will connect Puyallup to the Port of Tacoma. This means anyone here is technically trespassing. But that appears to be a small offense when you see what law enforcement found at the encampment.
Our auto theft task force, along with our CLD deputies, have been down here a couple times. We've recovered, up until today, about 30 stolen vehicles out of the area. We recovered another 10 today, which brings us to about 40 stolen vehicles recovered.
As of Saturday, law enforcement also arrested 6 people on felony warrants at the encampment. They also arrested another felon who was illegally possessing a shotgun. Fife police also report gunfire heard from the encampment on a nightly basis.
Usually it's just like, you know, drug trafficking, human trafficking, but I didn't know a big seize like that would happen here.
Isaac Fogalelli was pumping gas just blocks away from the encampment, which is technically in Fife, but also borders Tacoma and unincorporated Pierce County.
There's a big difference between struggling and then trying to take over.
Mike Smith agrees.
It's good they're cleaning things up, but on the other hand, they need to look at all the other side and make sure that what they're cleaning up isn't just a bunch of people that are just trying to make it. You know, try to help them out more, get rid of the bad, and help out those who really need it.
The Pierce County Sheriff's Office says homeless outreach specialists have been on site, offering resources for those trying to relocate. But these trespassing notices have also been put in place, giving anyone on the property 72 hours to relocate.
Okay. So my question is, just remove it. I don't get it. I don't get the hesitancy. So the headline on mynorthwest.com, I'll read it again. In light of everything you just heard, possible removal of South Sound homeless encampment after crimes found linked to it. Possible removal? I left a guy in the Cairo TV story that they're talking to that says, oh, usually it's just drug trafficking and sex trafficking down here. Usually that's just it. That's not bad. But then you heard the list of things happening there. 40 stolen vehicles at this one encampment. Again, in the city of Fife, borders Tacoma, unincorporated Pierce County. 40 stolen vehicles. That alone should be enough to clear the camp out. You know, I understand there's some protocols where you got to go in, try to get people help and all of this, but there's also, you know, other circumstances if you have something that's a clear and present public safety risk. And you talked about some of it. We just heard from Cairo TV, some of the other things that happened there. Somebody was arrested for felon in possession of a firearm after deputies found a shotgun. 6 people with felony warrants were there. Felony warrants from the State Department of Corrections, which means that they were already felons. And that they have some sort of warrant related to, you know, either not checking in with a probationary officer. So these are people who've been in trouble before. That's wild to me. Several gunshots from the area, the Pierce County Sheriff's Office says. You're telling me that you need to give notice to people to leave from a property that doesn't belong to them, where you found 40 stolen vehicles, where gunshots have been fired, 6 people have felony warrants out of DOC. There's drug trafficking and sex trafficking. You're telling me that you are going to, you owe them what? Why do you owe them 72 hours notice? Peyton, am I just not understanding?
I don't know. You make a lot of sense to me right now. And this whole thing, the possible for movement.
But even to the 72 hours notice, if you're talking about gunshots, it's a clear and present danger to the public. And I do understand the desire and the need not to just move homeless individuals from place to place. You know, you've got to offer them outreach, see if you can get them help for the underlying reasons that they're dealing with, whatever they're dealing with, or committing crimes. But what I see in this is a prioritization of the people in that camp, many of whom, according to the sheriff's office, are convicted criminals and engaged in criminal activity, versus a prioritization of the public and the health and safety of the public. And that doesn't make sense to me. And, you know, I've talked about this previously publicly, that my dad died homeless. 2 years ago, almost 3 years ago, you know, my dad struggled for most of my life as a child and, you know, almost his entire life with alcohol and drug abuse. He was also bipolar, which contributed to his substance abuse issues. And my dad died alone in a cheap motel room on the U.S.-Canadian border. And I've always used those experiences to try to inform my reporting on homelessness. And because of my experience with my dad, I've always had a profound amount of compassion for people who find themselves homeless. Because I understand that a variety of things have to be going wrong in your life to end up in that circumstance and in that situation. I also understand that homelessness is complex. You know, in our case, I could have thrown $1 million. I didn't have $1 million, but I could have thrown $1 million at my dad. He still would have died alone in a cheap motel room because it had gotten to the point where he was so far gone, he just could not or would not accept help. So whenever I see a story like this, I always lead with compassion. Like, I have compassion for homeless individuals. I do not believe it's productive to move camps from place to place without trying to actually address what's going on. But when you're looking at a story where you've got a camp where all the crime that they outlined is happening, stolen vehicles, illegal firearms, felons with warrants, sex trafficking, drug trafficking, that's not a homeless camp, that's a crime den. And it makes no sense to me why you would need to give those individuals the benefit of 72 hours notice before you come in and clear it out. That doesn't make sense to me. It makes sense in a lot of other situations. Like I said, I have empathy. I have compassion. A lot of situations in Seattle, if you've got a camp, an encampment that's, say, in a park and you want to get the park cleared out, 72 hours notice, send in your teams, offer them access to shelter, to drug and substance abuse help. And then go in 72 hours and do the cleanup. That makes sense to me. In this situation, that does not make sense to me. So this is, again, WashDOT property in the city of Fife, borders Tacoma, unincorporated Pierce County. And it's supposed to be used for construction of the 167 expansion. And there is all this stuff going on there. That is a wild story to me. At some point, common sense has to prevail, right? At some point, we need to say, look, we're empathetic people. We want homeless individuals to get better and to get off the streets. But at some point, we have to draw a clear line between people who are truly suffering and people who are inflicting suffering on others.
Wasn't that same thing said in Seattle, though? We got it. Common sense has to prevail at some point. Now, well, we're on year 17 of the 10-year homeless plan.
Yeah, this election hopefully started to change the tide. You have a mayor in Bruce Harrell in Seattle who supported sweeps of encampments, who said on the campaign trail, we want our sidewalks clear, we want our parks clear, we have empathy for people, but we also understand that regular citizens, tax-paying citizens, deserve to enjoy these spaces. And that's all we're saying. Is that really that unreasonable? Is that a right-wing conservative talking point? I don't think so.
Seems very reasonable.
As the daughter of someone who died homeless, I feel like I have the right to criticize what's happening down in Fife right now, and a 72-hour notice to get rid of a place that presents a clear and present danger to the public. All right, let's fit one more story in here. We want to go down to Tumwater. This is interesting. This is from Cairo 7, just came down. Tumwater Paper Mill fined $140,000 for failing to protect workers from COVID-19. Now, initially when it came to L&I and people ratting out employers and stuff and L&I levying giant fines against people trying to make a living, 9 times out of 10, I'm going to be opposed to that. This story, I am very on the fence about. And I'm going just off Cairo 7's reporting. I'm sure this company has its own version of events. But the details of this, I gotta say, they're a little bit disturbing. So this paper mill in Tumwater, West Rock Services, fined nearly $140,000 after one worker died and more than a dozen machine operators got sick with COVID-19. And I'm going to explain this whole story to you, but I want your feedback on this. The text line, 800-465-8770, 1-800-465-8770. So in March and April, there was an inspection from the Department of Labor and Industries at West Rock Services. And again, it revealed that 15 workers who worked on the same machine tested positive for COVID-19. One of them died, and two others were hospitalized, according to Cairo TV. Now, here's where things get a little, I guess, in my opinion, a little egregious. And I'd be curious to hear West Rock's version of this. The death and the hospitalizations were never reported to Labor and Industries as required. So you've got a death and hospitalizations related to COVID-19, middle of a pandemic, and this company is accused of not reporting them to L&I. And then it gets worse. So there was a machine operator apparently recovering from coronavirus. And the company has a nurse on site. And the guy tells the nurse, you know, hey, I'm in pain. I have shortness of breath. Apparently he was having difficulty walking. But rather than send him home, they had him stay at work and gave him supplemental oxygen because they were too short-staffed to send him home. And apparently, as a result of what that nurse did, a complaint was filed with the Nursing Care Quality Assurance Commission. And West Rock has appealed this fine of almost $140,000. I'm curious what you think of this, because I know that there is kind of this rush to say, gosh, you know, when L&I was fining restaurants trying to stay open and have indoor dining, this one seems like it's got a lot of layers to it. You know, including sort of not informing L&I of the deaths and the hospitalizations and, you know, maybe making a worker who was sick stay and work on supplemental oxygen. So I want to hear your thoughts on this. Send your thoughts in to the KTDH text line, 1-800-465-8770. Welcome back to the Jason Rantz Show. I am Brandi Cruz, filling in for my friend Jason Rantz while he's on probably a much-needed vacation. That man works like 100 hours a day.
He's still working over
there. I'm worried about him. He's got bags under his eyes. And I didn't want to tell him that about his Fox News appearances, but he needs more makeup under his eyes because he's not sleeping. I guess I'll pass that along to him on my own. All right, this was predictable, but still a very sad, sad commentary on the state of the internet and the state of the country. Of course, Wisconsin has been in the news quite a bit. One, because of the Kyle Rittenhouse trial in Kenosha, Wisconsin, which we're going to get to coming up at the top of the five. But also because, of course, over the weekend, there was that tragedy in Waukesha, Wisconsin, where an SUV plowed through a Christmas parade, killing five people. Some still, you know, clinging to life and injuring dozens more. So, of course, there were a lot of hot takes on the internet, as there often is, trying somehow to link the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict to the absolute tragedy and tragic loss of life in Waukesha, Wisconsin. There's a guy, the first tweet I saw about this was from a guy named Chris Wiggins, and I am shocked to say this tweet is still up. I thought for sure he would have bowed to pressure to delete it by now, but apparently he has no shame. Chris Wiggins, who's apparently like a former newscaster, I think he took his employer off his bio. That doesn't surprise me. But he retweeted a tweet from CNN saying multiple people injured, vehicle ran through a holiday parade. He goes, this is his tweet, it's okay. The driver in Waukesha was afraid for his life and defending himself from the unarmed holiday crowd. That's Wisconsin law now. Could you be a worse human? I mean, honestly. Well, apparently you can. Apparently you can be Mary Lemansky, who is the, or was rather, the social media director of the Democratic Party of DuPage County, Illinois. Because Mary Lemansky really got a kick out of the tragedy in Waukesha. Really thought that she would just tweet up a storm about it. Mary Lemansky, it was probably just self-defense, hashtag Kyle Rittenhouse, in reference to the people killed in the Christmas parade. She continues, the blood of Kyle Rittenhouse's victims is on the hands of Wisconsin citizens, even the children. Like, what does that even mean? This is another response. This one's the worst. You reap what you sow, Wisconsin. Apparently suggesting that because a jury of Wisconsin citizens acquitted Kyle Rittenhouse, that they deserve what's coming to them? She continues, someone who believes in reaping what you sow, referring to herself, Wisconsin put that bad energy out there. It came back real fast. Like, who are these people? This is a real human. So apparently, Mary Lemansky, again, the social media director of the Democratic Party of DuPage County, Illinois, has now resigned from her position. The DuPage Democrats tweeting, we are deeply saddened by the tragedy in Waukesha. We are aware of statements made by a former member of our organization and find them to be incredibly insensitive and not an alignment of who we are as an organization. Our organization does not support hate in any form. And so I don't know if Mary Lemansky resigned in lieu of termination. I'm assuming she would have been fired. At least that's what it suggests. But then, you know, Mary Lemansky apparently couldn't find any regret or remorse for her tweets, even in hindsight. Couldn't look back at them and say, you know what, those were a little callous. I shouldn't have said that. Because she then continued on Twitter to pretend as if now she was the victim in all of this. She wrote on Twitter, nobody cared about me, like my whole life. My mom used to leave me for hours at a time alone in my playpen. I've put out music for 20 years, nobody gave an S. Why do people all of a sudden care about a stupid remark? I can't believe my 15 minutes of fame is for this S. And look, I'm sorry if your mom didn't love you. I mean, that's horrible, and I feel bad for you. But you're not the victim in this. The five people who are dead in Waukesha are the victims. The people who are clinging to their lives in the hospital are the victims. And for you to not only insult them and insult their memories and insult what they went through just to get in a talking point on Kyle Rittenhouse, and then for you to act like you're the victim on Twitter. Mary, I hope you have some time to soul search.